So our next item is a report from our State Water Resource Control Board liaison, Mr. Steve Moore. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm gonna make sure this is on. Thank you, Chair Wolf and board members. It's been too long since I've had a chance to report to you. Last time I had an opportunity, I was flat on my back recovering from something. Some virus or something, I don't know what it was, but it rendered me unable to report and travel and that sort of thing. So I'm glad to be here today. And yes, since the last time we've met together, well, I did join you in Salinas in March, but even since then, there has been a lot of water under the bridge, as they say. There's a lot of activity at the State Water Board. So I really want to be sensitive to your time today, but I'm sure you would appreciate, you know, being caught up on some things. And your board member reports touched on some topics. I don't have to necessarily go into greater detail, but just echo what's going on there. When I give my, so I'm Steve Moore, your liaison from State Water Board. Been a member there for a couple of years. And I usually give my liaison reports according to kind of a structure where I'll talk about budget, recent activities, then upcoming activities, and then legislative considerations that are ongoing. And I know you're very interested in drought issues with the historic drought going on and discussions that are very active on groundwater management these days. And so I hope to provide a little insight into those processes. But there's so much more going on, so I want to touch on as much as I can. You know, the budget this year was passed, and back in January, we all noticed that the water boards had a lot of new things coming down the pike, and according to the governor's wishes, and most of that, if not all, was adopted into this year's budget. And so it included groundwater authority, discussions that relate to the legislation under consideration. That was 10 positions for this concept of unmanaged, unsustainable groundwater pumping. Of course, when we talk 10 positions, when you divide that by state board and the regions, it doesn't amount to a great deal, but it does mean additional resources for us to use and to try to address challenges. Also, with, as you mentioned, the transfer of the drinking water program from the Department of Public Health to the Water Board, that came with, I've got the number 290 positions, but, you know, more or less 300 folks around the state in Sacramento, but also the 23, I think, field offices and all of the public health expertise and experience that they bring to the board. And so, you know, let me take this opportunity to welcome the new drinking water division into our State Water Board, and what I call our new improved State Water Board. You know, I think bringing in source protection to tap water makes sense in terms of our goals for integrating water management and creating sustainability in water management in California. So it's an important step at the state level to align these authorities and to do a better job of coordinating them. And as Dr. Hunter mentioned, I think in the Central Coast region, you're ahead of a lot of the state as far as already having these relationships with what is now our Division of Drinking Water. And I just look forward to seeing that strengthened as we move forward with not only the environmental justice challenges, but just general water supply reliability challenges. Because as your staff noted in a very good comprehensive report in item 12 on your agenda, this region relies on groundwater for drinking water and domestic water supply more than any other region by a considerable amount. And so I think you already have these relationships going, and they're only going to be strengthened through these type of reorganizations. Some other budget items, we were given 11 positions and $1.8 million to work with Department of Fish and Wildlife on the vexing but important challenge of addressing marijuana cultivation and the effects both to water quantity through illegal diversion and also water quality in many ways erosion, pesticides, nutrients. It's an especially acute issue in Region 1, North Coast, as well as it's Region 5, Central Valley. But I know when I was on the Region 2 board, it was an issue in certain areas. I'm sure it is here too. And so that'll be an issue that'll be ongoing as the years go by. The 14 positions were approved for the hydraulic fracturing issue, and 12 positions were in the surface water ambient monitoring program, SWAMP, were taken from contracts and put into staff positions for this year. 10 positions were added, so was that about one per region or so, on the 401 certification program, which is our wetlands regulatory program that we coordinate with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Department of Fish and Wildlife. So those are some budget highlights and staffing highlights, high level. So recent activities. The State Water Board members participate in the Governor's Drought Task Force. And this is a panel of folks at the high level. Usually Felicia Marcus, our chair, participates. I've substituted for her one time. And we participate with the Office of Emergency Services, Department of Food and Agriculture, and our new Drinking Water Division folks, as well as Health and Human Services elements such as housing. And this is just an opportunity for us to explain to local communities around the state, whether it's, I know there was a meeting up in Redding or over in the Sierra foothills where the reservoirs are drying up in front of their eyes, you know, in places where there's really acute issues. And we know here in the Central Coast, communities like Cambria and San Simeon and others are looking at severe water shortages. And so the state is going around, and I'm not sure what the Central Coast strategy is exactly with the Drought Task Force, but they're making themselves available. And then also our website's got links on drought information to try to assist communities that are in serious trouble. You know, more than 400,000 acres of farmland around the state are expected to be fallowed. Thousands of people are gonna be out of work. Communities are at risk of running out of drinking water. There's thousands of people in the state that don't have drinking water because of quantity, not just the quality issues that Dr. Hunter talked about. And we're really fortunate that it's thousands and not hundreds of thousands, thanks to the three storm cycles that came through in February and March of this year. So we really see the seriousness of what we're going through now, but also the need to plan for a possible drought year in 2015, you know, and what that means. That's when we go from thousands of people to hundreds of thousands of people that will be directly affected. So for these reasons, in the two executive orders from the governor and the legislation on March 1st, SB 104, the drought emergency legislation, gave the State Water Board emergency authorities to adopt regulations to ensure reliable water supply and to respond to the drought challenges. And you probably have read or heard about the emergency conservation regulations that we adopted on July 15th and were made law Tuesday of this week. And you can boil it down to kind of two things. One is actions that are reasonable for each Californian to do, and that also translates to businesses, schools, institutions, places where all of us as individual citizens have seen not the best use of water, you know, in terms of just oversight, not purposeful, but in such a serious drought situation, clearly unreasonable. And that's where we bring in our authority on what constitutes waste and unreasonable use of water. So after two full days of hearings, you know, we agreed that four certain things are reasonable to ask of everyone, businesses, individuals, that it is not reasonable to wash your driveway or sidewalk with water. That's not reasonable for your irrigation system to create runoff that goes into the gutter. It's not reasonable to wash your car and leave the hose running. If you have a shut-off valve, then maybe that's reasonable. We, of course, encourage you to go to places that use recycled water and recirculate water. And then finally, fourth, it's not reasonable to have an ornamental fountain that doesn't recirculate. Those are the four things. Not too radical, not too out in front, but a reasonable set of guidelines that now there's authority given to local water agencies and even law enforcement to issue citations. First warnings, the usual progressive enforcement, but ultimately up to $500 fines for noncompliance. So I hope that gives you a sense. I want to take a little time to explain sort of the goal there. Actually, the state and regional boards maintain enforcement authority as well, but we're kind of that backstop. And over a 270-day period of emergency regulation, you know, we don't anticipate getting out there at our level, but certainly we stand ready to support any local efforts. Now, that's not going after individual Californians. It's just setting a tone about we should be paying attention. So that's the first element. And then the second element is raising expectations and the reporting from water agencies throughout the state. There are 443 water utilities that serve more than 3,000 customers. And so that's, to get that perspective, you know, we have 58 counties in the state, but we have 443 water purveyors, over 3,000 connections, and then we have over 2,500 water purveyors that are less than 3,000 connections. So it's quite a fragmentation. And so I think you can quickly appreciate that to have accurate information on water use and water efficiency throughout our state is a daunting challenge. And so we did conduct a survey, and we learned a lot. We only got 276 out of the 443 actually responded to the survey, which is part of what you've read in the news in terms of the responsiveness to this drought emergency our governor declared. But that said, we've learned a lot about sort of the unevenness of the information. So as part of this regulation, we're requiring monthly reporting on water production use to the State Water Board from these 443 agencies. So this will get us a better idea about water use that we can track moving forward, especially if this drought continues. It's important to remind folks that this is the third year of drought. It's really six of 7 years that have been drought. And Australia went through a 9 to 10 year drought, and it caused them to completely change the way they manage water. And so I think looking ahead, they provide some lessons learned that we're paying close attention to as we make our way into what we hope to be the next rainy season, but we can't guarantee it. We also have done some curtailments. This is something that comes up every 10 years or so when we're dealing with droughts, and folks kind of forget. You know, if 10 years go by, then it's like, what is the state board doing? They're cutting water rights. But actually, is this a routine that we go through? It's simple math in terms of the water budget that's available in the watershed versus the documentation we have on water rights. And we compare that, and when we start seeing that there's not enough water, we issue curtailments. And it's, as I alluded to earlier in the Central Coast, water supply is so dependent on groundwater that it's interesting that the curtailment watersheds haven't reached into your region yet. You know, it's the Eel River, Sacramento, San Joaquin, Russian, Scott River on the Klamath, and then some specific tributaries in Sacramento that relate to endangered spring run Chinook, where we actually set minimum flows and issue curtailments and an enforcement order on folks that weren't abiding by these emergency regulations in Deer Creek in Tehama County. So we're showing that we're trying to, in good faith, implement the emergency regulations that the governor has expected us to, and to prioritize them in areas where there's possible irreversible impact. So So I'm going to give you a flavor for that. Other things we recently did, we issued the statewide water recycling order on June 3rd, and Chair Wolf alluded to that your RCD committee, agricultural committee, was looking at enhancing the use of recycled water in agricultural areas. That was really the intent of this statewide order, where we took language from an existing region to San Francisco Bay region order and applied it statewide. This was a 1996 order that's really facilitated the use of recycled water, especially in the vineyards and other agricultural areas in the North Bay. So, and it turns out I actually worked on that as a staff person back in the 90s. So as things come around full circle. It's pretty limited because it's more regional in scope. I think what that order showed was we just didn't see signals of problems in that type of setting. It's not to say that there aren't significant issues in places, even in Region 2, like the Livermore Valley, where salt and nutrient management is critical, and recycled water could exacerbate a problem, right? So it's not to say those aren't issues, but it's more of a streamlined approach, and it creates less burden to applying the recycled water in terms of reporting and monitoring. It's not that it's not ignored, but it's a lot less than some orders around the state. We, in March, going back a ways, but we did okay the set aside of $800 million in SRF funding for recycled water at almost half the interest rate at 1%. And there's a 2-year window on that. So for communities in the Central Coast that may not have sort of, you know, plans all ready to go but no funding, but rather they need to get the plans going, there's time, you know, to really dust off those efforts and take advantage of 1% financing. We have that window open all the way to December of 2015. We adopted amendments to the Caltrans MPDS permit for stormwater discharges that incorporate TMDL requirements. And I highlight that because I thought it was a really good exercise where our technical staff got together with Caltrans and grouped pollutants that are commonly addressed by certain BMPs. So there was a logic to sort of the project-based, you know, building the roads, and then you put these BMPs in, which will address not only sediments, but mercury, you know, and nutrients. And so there was a systematic kind of engineering mindset, but I think is very useful. And this model, and it sets up their expectations for their annual work plans and their capital plans at Caltrans. And it also gets their engineers incorporating water quality protection in the design up front. You know, it's water and transportation engineering concurrently. So I'm excited about that because I think we've put our foot in the door. You know, they still, you know, it'll be a decade in the making, but a decade goes by, the hope is they really will start designing roads a certain way. And guess what? That has a great effect in terms of affecting county road departments, municipal road departments, and how they build roads. So I thought it was a big deal. And I look forward to working with Caltrans cooperatively moving forward. And that's issues like the low impact development principles that you all champion. Just wanted to compliment staff in your TMDL division on the Santa Maria pesticides, TMDL that we approved this month. You know, it was a morning long hearing where we really got into extensive discussion about some of the nuts and bolts of numeric targets and cutting edge science that's done at Moss Landing Marine Labs. And so I thought, you know, we were able to clarify that there weren't imminent regulatory consequences for using these tools, but they help us as the water boards track our own performance in terms of achieving TMDL targets. And so it was a really fruitful discussion. Your staff did a great job. So there's lots of stuff we've been doing. You mentioned the authorization of cleanup and abatement funds for drinking water, and we're excited to have our Division of Drinking Water really help with that. They also, another aspect of that is the SRF funding for safe drinking water is now really more closely coordinated with our clean water, which should really yield efficiencies from the lessons learned and the improvements we've made by establishing the Division of Financial Assistance about 10 years ago, by organizing around a goal, for lack of a better technical term, to move the money, you know, just to do our level best to get things out the door and helping communities. That really helped our performance, and we hope that can help out the drinking water folks too. There's a Clean Beaches Initiative grant that was given this month to Pacific Grove for a really great project. It was a $3,289,000 grant out of Clean Beaches to Pacific Grove for Lover's Point to do rehabilitation of storm drain and sanitary sewer. I want to call attention to a new initiative. We had some leftover bond funds. We call it the Drought Response Outreach Program for Schools, or a nice little acronym, DROPS. So remember DROPS. It's and it's not just, you might think, oh, we're going to put in a bunch of low-flow toilets and things like that. Actually, this is something that relates to initiatives you all are championing about providing funding for public school facilities to implement stormwater capture and infiltration projects that provide multiple benefits, including educating students about sustainable water management practices. And so staff's been going around the state, did meetings in Sacramento and Ontario, a workshop in Sacramento, it's going down to San Diego, and we're receiving comments on the guidelines of this new program. I'm excited about it because when I, you know, I share your goals about low impact development implementation and the stormwater groundwater nexus and stream flow. And when you think about it, the schools are a big footprint on the landscape and a big opportunity. And of course, there's always, you know, educating the next generation and the green jobs of the future associated with planning our landscape that's water sustainable. The nitrate report to legislature, you're familiar with the expert panel, that's the short term. You know, our recommendation 14 of our XB21 Senate bill report, we convened a panel of experts and met the week of May 5th to 9th of this year. I don't know if any of you happen to attend, but we do have that. The full meetings are on our website. You know, in terms of if you want to re-experience the expert panel. I did sit in on a July 18th hearing where they presented their report, or they were just getting input on it. They didn't really present the report, but they were getting input. And I know you all have been active and your staff have been active in this effort. And I think, you know, and so we're taking very seriously the input that we're getting from Region 3 here and also Region 5. In terms of, you know, the tone of the report that's out there now, it's available on our website, it points out limitations, as scientists do, right? You know, you can't, you know, what's your confidence level in terms of this information, what kind of conclusions you can draw? Okay, that's fine, we respect that, but we also want to know more about what we can do, you know, what conclusions we can draw. So we're having the expert panel go back and retool the report a little bit to give us some more direct guidance on more of the opportunities of these data collection efforts that you're helping lead, as opposed to just the limitations. So I'll just leave it at that high level that we're taking seriously the input we're getting. But we think there's a great deal of value. We stand by our recommendation for the expert panel because it's so helpful to get that outside academic advice and also to team with our sister agency, Department of Food and Agriculture, you know, to really show that we're interested in a multidisciplinary review of how we manage nitrate in agricultural settings and how we go about monitoring our effectiveness. We're going to, coming up, real quickly, I'll hit it bullet. We're doing the desalination ocean plan amendments. You've heard me talk about this for a while, but we're actually having hearings on the proposed amendments. starting on August 6th. And we hope to adopt the amendments to the ocean plan for desalination by the end of the year. The salt and nutrient management planning, at this point, the update from the regional boards indicates that about 91% of the groundwater monitoring and assessment program priority basins by area, and 47% of all groundwater basins are covered by a salt and nutrient management planning group. And I think that's good news that we're making progress in fulfillment of the recycled water policy expectations. And I appreciate your efforts here in this region to make that happen. That remains an active area. The statewide water quality plan amendments for trash. We had a workshop this month. We heard from some folks in the Central Coast region. You know, this is an issue where San Francisco region and LA have, you know, been out front a little, learning things, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work. And so we're trying to learn from that at the state board to set some minimum expectations for trash control. It's a good surrogate indicator for urban runoff pollution control. Let's just be honest. If you see a bunch of trash, there's probably other stuff going on too in your urban waterways. And there's the issue of persistent trash in the ocean, and you all, if any region, would be sensitive to that. But it was interesting, you know, the input we received from the stakeholders in this region was some concern about cost, of course, you know, and the infrastructure expectations for trash control, and so we want to work carefully through that with them, but also facilitate, you know, what we've learned in other regions on this and implement it at an appropriate level throughout this region and all the state. So we're working on the trash issue. You all mentioned the Water Quality Coordinating Committee, the WQCC. This region's always real supportive of that effort. We appreciate you traveling. You probably have one of the hardest travel burdens to Sacramento of any region. And this year, we're excited. We're going to talk about how stormwater and groundwater interact. You touched on that and where integration is needed. And I'm going to be co-leading a wetlands, segment on Friday morning, I think, with the chair of the San Diego Regional Board. And, you know, I've had some experience in the regulatory program, so we'll talk about the regulatory program, but also kind of our challenge to look at the benefits of wetlands, you know, in an integrated water management framework and what we can do to improve our programs. I like to say, can we broaden this to not just play defense, but to play offense, you know, to actually get out there and build wetlands and build streams as opposed to just protecting the ones that we have, which is important, but shouldn't be a sole focus. Hydraulic fracturing, an area of high interest in the city we're in here today, and with its history of oil and gas exploration in this area. And there's an August 7th first meeting in Bakersfield related to the SB 4 legislation on the State Water Board's requirement to develop model groundwater monitoring criteria for hydraulic fracturing. And we're holding it in Bakersfield because that's near where about over 70% of hydraulic fracturing occurs today, has for decades. And we've invited stakeholders to participate in the development of these model criteria to assess the potential effects of oil and gas related activities on the state's groundwater resources, which is required by SB 4. So I've got some notes here on, I just wanted to thank your staff on item 12 on tying in the groundwater, the GAP, the Groundwater Assessment and Protection Program that's connected to your CCAMP program, and linking that to the basin plan and the triennial review and integrated water management. And I just thought I had a chill when I read it because I was so so excited that, and the reason why is I used to be a basin plan chief. You know, you may not know this, but at San Francisco. And I think the basin plan is a wonderful opportunity to, in a collaborative way, bring in integrated water management principles that have been agreed to by stakeholders and really give them, you know, regulatory and planning authority, you know, empowering the locals. And why is it so exciting? Because it is organized according to watershed. It's organized according to groundwater basin boundaries. And much of our frustration relates to the fragmentation of water governance that doesn't align with watershed boundary. And so we work really hard to work together. We come up with MOAs, MOUs, JPAs, the Integrated Regional Water Management Program. There's 48 of them. Some do more integration than others, but we've taken a step toward this direction. But the question today is, how do we sustain that? How do we sustain those relationships when state bond funding is not necessarily certain? It's a real big question, and we shouldn't let what we've achieved just go away. And so I appreciate you thinking about how integrated water management fits in the basin plan, because the basin plan won't go away. And it's a place maybe where we can think critically, the whole state, your region as well, on how we better use that tool. So thank you for letting me talk about that a little bit. And finally, legislation. It's very active these days. I have a list of 10. I won't go over all of them. They're looking at water resources. But there's this week, just 2 days ago, there was a meeting about the two groundwater legislation bills. There's an AB 1739, Dickinson, and SB 1168, Pavley. And those are supposed to be reconciled, so we're not using them one against the other kind of thing. And that's the direction. And so this week they're really hammering out what there are in common, so we're dealing with one target. And just to give you some high-level overview of what is in the sausage factory right now, what's in the machinery, this bill would establish the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. It would apply to all groundwater basins in the state. It applies to the United States and an Indian tribe to the extent authorized under federal and tribal law. The act does not apply to adjudicated basins except for the provision of the judgment or judicial order and annual reporting of groundwater use. So we still get the data. Because some of those adjudications, as you well know, dealt with the concept of safe yield, so you don't let the ground drop, but not necessarily sustainable yield, where you're looking at interactions of groundwater to surface water and other factors. So even the adjudicated basins, I think, you know, can be revised. There are timetables that are being looked at. This is all pretty draft still, but the idea is that by 2017, you figure out who is what's called the Groundwater Sustainability Agency. Now, existing agencies can say, I'm that, you know, I'm that, whatever you're calling it. I'm the Groundwater Sustainability Agency for this basin, or we are, or this group is. So we can take advantage of all the hard work that's been done to date in certain basins. But, you know, there's other basins. There is another piece of legislation in the works, as you're well aware, the Paso Robles Water Basin District concept. And so if that comes to fruition this legislative session, then they would be an example of a sustainability agency. There would be some expectations on the agency's powers and authorities. Maybe some updates need to be made in terms of things like the ability to collect fees to support the program. I gave you an overview of our groundwater concept paper last fall, and we have the five elements at the State Water Board. Through all these hearings, we've stayed true to those principles, and I think they're finding their way into the legislation as far as what the expectations are for a local groundwater management agency. It wasn't just us saying this is how it shall be. We did meet with AQUA and other experts to kind of reaffirm that these principles. And currently the idea is that DWR, Department of Water Resources, would review the technical information and if they're meeting the expectations of the sustainability agency, and the Water Board would have the discretion to apply pressure incrementally, this idea of the state backstop, DWR could refer folks to us, and there would be four points of entry that we're looking at. One would be whether local authorities have failed to have sub-basin-wide governance within 2 years. This is just ideas that aren't official yet. Number two, when local authorities fail to adopt a sub-basin-wide plan in 5 years. So they're setting out timetables. Number three, if DWR determines the plan's inadequate, or the board, water board, determines that the basin is in a state of long-term overdraft or has significant depletions of interconnected surface water. That's the third point. The fourth point where the state could come in is if DWR determines the implementation is inadequate, that there's this long-term overdraft. And that sounds a lot like the number three. So see, this is very drafty. So at any rate, I want to give you a sense of the point of entry. That's a big question in everyone's mind. When would the state come in? And when we talk state water board, we're talking about state and regional water boards. The state board is the actor, but we certainly are working closely with you. So there's some serious details being worked out. In the end, it's going to be the policy of the state that the groundwater resources be managed sustainably for the long-term water supply reliability and the multiple social, economic, and environmental benefits and the current and the future beneficial uses. So this will be helpful to get us, our leg toward the right direction, the right trajectory. And I always like to remind folks that, and Cami Argovecchi, who's the DWR Integrated Water Management Director, we're in there reminding folks, this is great, but let's not further fragment our water governance by setting up a new groundwater bureaucracy that's not paying attention to its connections with surface water and all the other issues with recycled water, stormwater, wetlands, fish and wildlife, et cetera. So we're doing our best to remind folks of that. I hope we're successful. And thank you. I apologize for the length of this overview, but I just wanted to make you feel like you're confirm that you're part of a lot of what's going on, and answer any questions you have.
Thank you for your comprehensive report, and I think Mr. Young has a question.
Good morning, Mr. Moore, and always a pleasure to hear from you, and that was a very comprehensive report. And in the end, it strikes me that, this interest we've all had with water quality, over the years, has really brought us, to a point in time, not because of our own doing, but because we're just happen to be here. It's, coincidental that we have these huge water issues that we've never seen before. I mean, it's really unprecedented. We've been through, drought cycles before, but given the size of the population, the demands on our resources, our system is really being challenged like I've never seen before in my lifetime. But a couple of questions for you. The state's emergency regulations on drought seems to be targeting urban use and what is considered to be waste/unreasonable. Is there any thought given to looking at non-urban use and applying those same concepts, waste, unreasonableness, in terms of use? Mm-hmm. And I mean ag. Mm-hmm. Because doesn't ag use 80% of our water? And not that it's not a necessary use of our water, but it seems like if we're really trying to save some water, if we've only got 20% in the urban use and 80% in the ag use, perhaps there are some ag practices that could be made more efficient. Maybe some shouldn't take place in certain locations. So is there any discussion about this?
Yeah, so this is a very relevant and common question that especially came up in the wake of the July 15th discussions, with the emergency regs for urban use. Well, how about ag? Roughly maybe 80%. And so what was maybe lost and understandably overlooked in those questions was the fact that the previous two emergency regulations targeted agricultural use mostly and was kind of pushed the needle, if you will, on drawing attention to the limited water availability in specific watersheds, but mostly surface water. So to try to illustrate that, the hearings are about 4 days of hearings where we were contemplating emergency regulations that would curtail senior water rights, pre-1914 and riparian rights, based on the math that I described. You know, there's a certain amount of water in the reservoirs. DWR provides us the technical information. And then we have all the water rights on the books, and we have them stacked according to priority, you know, first in time, first in right. And we've reached a point in drought where the senior rights may need to be curtailed in many places. And then would we apply our emergency enforcement authority to the senior rights? And we proposed to do it. We compromised to say, well, we'll enforce on the junior, the post 14. But even then, that telescopes the process for enforcement relative to the existing approach, which is very hearing intensive, and you can't actually cut the water off until the hearing process has taken its course. And at that point, you know, the winter is here kind of thing. So the emergency regulations are in effect, which pushes the needle in terms of enforcing hard curtailments on water right holders that are principally agricultural. And so, and also we did advance warning in January when things were very dire that we anticipated curtailments. And we hope, I think, you know, we didn't have it didn't happen the way we always want it, but we send the advance signal so that the agricultural interests can make adjustments based on, you know, what DWR is projecting in terms of available water, so that that year where you don't have permanent crops, there might be fallowed land. And I mentioned there's over 400,000 acres of fallowed land this year. So there were efforts to really target agricultural use through water rights curtailments this year. And so if you talk to the folks in those watersheds, they'll say, oh yeah, the state's coming after us for limited water. But you're right, we're not going into the level of saying, hey, there's runoff from your fields, you're not being efficient. So, you know, I hear that a lot of folks in the urban sector would like to see more of, maybe more of that in agriculture, but we don't go to that level. It's more in terms of what water is provided.
I'd like to give Mr. Young a specific example of some actions being taken. The County of San Luis Obispo, the planning department has requested the Agricultural Liaison Advisory Board of the county to help develop a agriculture water waste set of guidelines. And the water waste set of guidelines address water running down ditches, unnecessarily sprinklers aimed at roads rather than the field, broken lines, which irrigation lines, which are not being repaired in a timely fashion. And this set of ordinances is being developed by a representation of the various agriculture commodities within the county.
That's helpful, and also recognizing a lot of work done, agricultural water management plans that are in effect, not everywhere, but in a lot of places in the state.
Separately. Is there any discussion or thought being given to what happens post 2015 if the drought continues? Mm-hmm. I mean, is there discussion about putting in big desalination plants or something to actually create water? Mm-hmm. So far, we're just talking about different ways to conserve water.
Right.
Where's it going to come from?
That's right. And you know, and so that's the portfolio approach. So we're talking about conservation because we're not getting a paycheck, we're just living off our savings account, right? So we need to conserve that savings account of water. And then this is statewide. You know, the whole state is in drought. And then that was the intent of, let's do what we can. So to do the low interest loans for recycled water, to really break down the permit barriers to, you know, watering farms with recycled water, because that's a drought-proof source of water, if you know. But it does mean infrastructure. And you mentioned desalination. I'm going to visit the Carlsbad desalination facility that's going to provide 50 million gallons a day to San Diego in next year, the year after. But there's time, I would just point out that it takes a lot of time to get that all, the site situated with the Coastal Commission, the thing built, and then what we're trying to do with our desal amendments is make it clear about the path of what the design should be to protect the environment. So there's a lag, there's a 10-year lag from the point of when you want to have permanent desal versus temporary desal, which a version is that is here in this city in Santa Barbara.
I don't think we would have 10 years to wait if
right.
we go a couple of more years or 3 years. I mean, I think there'd be some.
I was just going to say, yesterday we had a conference call with State Board to talk about the emergency regs, and I asked that very same question that you ask, and almost every agency in state government now is focused on the drought. One of the things that's happening is, I guess, DGS is actually talking to the Navy. Nuclear-powered warships have tremendous abilities to make fresh water. So they're in talks with the fleet in San Diego about the potential use of Navy ships to generate desal water on an emergency basis. So those are some of the kinds of things that they're thinking about. And also the State Board is looking at the next iteration of emergency regs to turn the screws, so to speak, if the condition continues to worsen. So there's a lot going on right now.
That's good to know.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you make the point, and it's a good point. We do have, there is a lot of water in the state still, right. And it's used for different things. And so we're looking closely at where communities are getting to the stress point, where their health and safety is an issue. And we remain open to exercising our emergency regulation to protect those communities.
Okay. The two bills on groundwater sustainability, the AB and the SB, do we publicly know if the governor's going to sign those bills?
Oh. we don't know publicly, but we that the governor's office has shown the leadership,
right?
In convening the workshops and making, and then in this California Water Action Plan, which is the governor's action plan, sustainable groundwater management is front and center. Clearly one of the actions. And so folks are working cooperatively. We're trying to figure out how local authorities can be enhanced and management be at the local level. But to be clear about what the expectations are, and then even in the event of state intervention, that it creates expectations for what the state would do. It should be very lockstep consistent with what we expect locals to do. So I'm hopeful that we will be the 50th state to regulate groundwater pumping.
And Mayor? All right, thank you. Thank you, Steve, for another lengthy report that I think is warranted. I appreciate it. The more content, the better. I'm very happy to hear all of it. Recently, I think Executive Officer Ken Harris sent out an email that referred to some information on groundwater being designated a public trust doctrine by a superior court somewhere or a court. Can you relate to that, what that means? I didn't understand it.
Well, not a lawyer, but I would just say from a high level, I think all kind of, I always try to strike those themes that we can all agree on, and I think the Californians can generally agree that groundwater is a shared resource. And in cases where there's scarcity, we reach points where certain individuals have an advantage over others in the shared resource that we all depend on. They got a deeper well, they happen to be located in that area where the water table intersects their well and their neighbor doesn't. And so there's a public trust component to shared resources. But, you know, we have a system of water rights that goes back over a century. It creates stability financially and socially. And, you know, it's not, I think, a great stretch to imagine a future where the water rights to groundwater are structured in a socially, environmentally, economically sustainable manner. And I think thinking of the public good fits into that strongly.
So I heard my colleague say that that may have just referred to Scott River. So that was a very specific case, I guess. And I think what I'm hearing between the lines that you're speaking is that that may be a harbinger of something of more to come. Like, that seems to be the general pattern to come in our society, where we're looking at groundwater more as a public trust doctrine in the future than it has been in the past.
Yeah, I think there's a first step where we recognize, you know, that it isn't a limitless resource from a management standpoint. You know, in adjudicated basins, we recognize that. It's, you know, like you take Orange County, very detailed, you know, the fees that people pay, it's all tied together with managing the water levels. It's adjudicated, you know, but in areas where that hasn't happened, then we have unintended consequences on, say, in the Scott River of depleting surface waters. And that affects water rights in the surface water. And so, you know, first step is to get groundwater to a certain management level. And then there's another step that's related to existing efforts of our public trust unit in water rights today to really look at the science and work with Fish and Wildlife and academic and professional experts on what the minimum stream flows should be in different water years and different watersheds. So we're committed to really getting to the bottom of the technical basis for what you mean by public trust, and to have the dialogue about how we reconcile that with our water rights system so that we have a sustainable water resource future.
And I have what might seem to be a peripheral issue. You talked a bit about trash. And I've understood there's a statewide legislation for reusable bag or plastic bag ban ordinance, whatever you want to call it. Can you give an update of that? And if not, that's okay.
Yeah, this is a substantive issue with the trash amendment. Some interested parties, more on, you know, in environmental organizations, but not all environmental organizations, would like to see our water boards, you know, have some regulatory requirements for those type of actions. You know, they call it regulatory source control in the current discussion. It is controversial because, you know, that I liken that to the use of pesticides. They're registered for use by the Department of Pesticide Regulation. So for us to address pesticides, we have to work cooperatively with them. We can't just say, you know, you can't use that pesticide, right? Because it's been registered. Similarly, we have a similar challenge where you can't use that plastic bag, because it to be registered, it should go through Department of Toxic Substance Control or other authorities that register products. So, and same with copper and brake pads. You know, we can't just say you can't have brake pads with copper. We can work with the industry, work with product registration. So I bring those issues out that, but for us to say you can't use plastic bags because they might hurt water quality, or do hurt water quality in certain settings, isn't necessarily the path where we have clear legal authority. So it's controversial. But where we do have clear legal authority is stormwater discharges and discharges from property that affect waterways.
Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. Welcome back, Mr. Moore. Sort of along the line of Jeff's comments, too, although I wouldn't categorize it as a waste, but, you know, there's still for coastal communities, there's still a significant amount of what starts out as clean water and then becomes waste and then is treated water that gets discharged into the ocean. You know, locally, I'm sure my numbers are wrong since the drought started, but I think the city of Santa Barbara produces 12 million gallons a day of clean drinking water, And when their recycling facility is working, by the time you get to the end of the pipe, they recapture 2 million gallons of that, but they put another 6 or 7 million out into the bay. And they have both recycling capability and delivery capacity limits that limit them to that 2 million recapture. So the other 6 million goes out into the bay. But is there talk, and this isn't, you know, it's not an immediate drought strategy, obviously, because it's capital improvements and pipes under the ground. And mm-hmm. But are there more discussions rather than just removing barriers like the legislation is doing, but to actually placing requirements into the next decade or decades out to recapture and reuse that water?
Mm-hmm. That was a topic of discussion at our February drought hearing on water efficiency and suggestion by some stakeholders, such as the Pacific Institute and Heal the Bay, and others are interested in a prohibition of discharge to the ocean. The state of Florida has a prohibition for wastewater to go into the ocean. It's an interesting policy topic. I think you have to always look at the whole picture and if there are unintended consequences. But we've been asked to consider that. You know, it's not front and center on our plate right now.
Thank you. Any other question from my colleagues? Mr. Johnston?
Just briefly, I was up on the Upper Klamath River this week, and not only have I never seen it so low, but everywhere I'd looked, there was algae, blue-green algae, coming down from the dams, the Iron Gate and the dams up the river. Mm-hmm. And I understand they're tremendously concerned about it up there and struggling to figure out how to deal with it. And in that vein, I want to express my appreciation to the State Board for granting $750,000 to the city of Watsonville to do what's a somewhat experimental treatment on blue-green algae in Pinto Lake. It's a small lake in a small watershed and a good place to experiment. And this is something that, as the rivers and lakes in our state get warmer, that we're going to be seeing more and more with huge, huge consequences. So I want to express my appreciation to that. And I think it'll be money well spent.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to know what you're doing in your spare time with all this effort. My concern is, with all the effort that all of us are doing, state board, regional boards, citizens, and so forth, to conserve water during this period, as soon as it starts to rain, everybody forgets about what has happened in the past. What is the state board going to do to make sure that we are prepared, because it's a cycle, and in the future that we don't repeat this and take this amount of time to get to where we are again in the future? Mm-hmm. And you know, you talked about being proactive and thinking ahead. I know from over the years when we've had droughts that everybody's concerned, everybody tries to do their best, but as soon as it starts to rain, all that goes away. So my question is, what is preparation for the next cycle mm-hmm. of drought? Because we're gonna approach this pretty soon.
Yeah.
Again.
No, it's true. Not only are reservoirs down, but groundwater basins are down, and so we're getting a double whammy. So what? And the question is relevant. I've said, you know, even if El Nino did produce rain next year, we still need to be managing for drought. You know, what have we done to enhance capture of that stormwater into groundwater or, you know, other off-stream storage for agricultural use? You know, and what are we doing to try to, you know, with our limited funds to encourage that? I was here in January for a dedication of a bunch of parking lots and parks here in Santa Barbara with the mayor, Helene Schneider, and others. And it's a fantastic project because it made the park look nicer, but it also recharges the groundwater, which is 50% of Santa Barbara's water supply in an area that's strategic. You know, and it also helps the low flow of the stream nearby Mission Creek to keep going longer through the summer, even in a drought condition. So, you know, these infrastructure investments, and then also the ability to use recycled water in drought, which is a drought-proof water supply. So the more that we incrementally do this work, the better. And I submit we're doing much better today than we would have in the 90s because of the infrastructure we've invested in for recycled water and groundwater recharge. But certainly we can do much more, and we'll continue to be aggressive and use the drought message even if we get a deluge next spring, because we'll say, now's the time to manage for drought. Now's the time to make sure this water is there when we need it.
Thank you. So appreciate your inputs and response. So Mr. Harris, would you please introduce the next item?
Before I do, I just want to comment on Mr. Moore, a couple of things that he said. Mr. Robinson and I will be going to Bakersfield for that workshop next week, and the paperwork for our fracking position will go to Sacramento next week. So we're actively engaged in getting that person on board.